As a climate scientist, Dr. Heidi Roop believes that when it comes to global warming, every action matters, be it individual, local, or government. While the scale of the climate crisis can feel overwhelming, she also wants us to have hope, something often overlooked in climate change conversations. And that's what led her to research her new book, The Climate Action Handbook, a visual guide to 100 climate solutions for everyone. She joins us now from St. Paul, Minnesota, where she directs the University of Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership. Heidi, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, a lot of us are smart people, but we don't understand the science of it. In a very simple nutshell, can you give us a review on that? The problem, the cause, the solution.
The problem simply is us. The combustion, the creation of what we call greenhouse gases that when put in the atmosphere, trap heat, causes the planet to warm and warm outside of the range of natural climate variability. That in turn causes the climate system to operate in a different way. It amplifies rain events, droughts, flood events that stem from those rain events. And so this is simply a physics challenge. We know clearly the connection between greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the temperature of the planet, our climate system, and thus the impacts that we experience. And unfortunately, the fingerprints of climate change are everywhere, and they're here now, and not very far from a place near you or a place you love.
You have a sentence in your book, "Once we emit, we commit." Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this comes back to physics again, those pesky physics. So greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide are long-lived in our atmosphere. So once we create them through things like producing energy or insert the many of things that we all do every day that rely on fossil fuels. So what might simply be a short dash down the street or a quick flight over to Europe actually produces heat-trapping gases that stay in the atmosphere, in some cases, well over 1,000 years. There are other gases like methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas, meaning it traps more heat per molecule than something like carbon dioxide. It's in the atmosphere for a lot less time. So we're worried about those short-lived greenhouse gases as well as the long-lived greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, which is why you hear about technologies that want to actively remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The reason we want to do that is because once we emit it, we're committed unless we actively find a way to remove it, physically remove it from the atmosphere.
So there's something I got out of your book that kind of shows we have a certain track we're on, an inertia. And if we do something now, the result is it's like redirecting a huge ship. You know, you can turn the steering wheel, but it doesn't redirect it right away. It's people don't understand the long-term impact of today's actions.
That's absolutely right. And that's one of the difficult opportunities of the work that I get to focus on. You know, I lead an organization called the Climate Adaptation Partnership. Adaptation is just basically a fancy word for preparing for those impacts of climate change that we know, quite frankly, we've already set in motion.
Adaptation just depresses me.
Yes, it's also an opportunity. So similar to the, you know, we refer a lot and folks may be familiar hearing things like 1.5 degrees Celsius and we have a decade left. This is all language that's derived from the science of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is essentially our global authority. I think what a lot of people don't realize, they point not only to the rapid reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. The next decade is going to be critical for society to actually prepare for those changes. We both have to prevent the problem from getting worse by reducing emissions, while we also seek to prepare for those changes that we know we've set in motion.
You know, when I was little, we had shop and we had home ec in middle school. It seems like we need a new class that every student has to take, and it would be climate science, just so they can understand what's going to change their and their children and their grandchildren's world.
I might offer a title suggestion for that course that I do think should be a common course, which is Climate Science and Solutions. Nice. I think we need to start empowering people to see the way that they can be part of the solution and not just understand and live through, quite frankly, the real monumental challenge before us. I think adaptation does that. Adaptation is the antidote in a lot of ways because it enables us to think about what is the future we want to create and how do we get there.
Man, that's the philosophy. It comes through so clearly in your book. We're considering the global climate change crisis right now and what we can each do to help prevent it here on Travel with Rick Steves. Our guest is Dr. Heidi Roop. Her book is The Climate Action Handbook, a guide to 100 climate solutions for everyone. Dr. Roop is an assistant professor of climate science and the director of the Climate Adaptation Partnership at the University of Minnesota. Her website is HeidiRoop.com. Heidi, this is a travel show, and let's talk about the elephant in the room right now, travel and climate change. I'm all over traveling traveling in a thoughtful way that helps me be a citizen of the planet when I get home, but it contributes to climate change. So what I'm trying to wrestle with is traveling in a way that's carbon neutral, mitigation. It seems to me mitigation is a hopeful word. You can create as much good as you create bad. It's nothing heroic. It's just baseline, but it's ethical to pay your carbon cost. Is it possible to pay our carbon costs and be more ethical travelers? What are your thoughts?
It's complicated. And I think we're a ways away from it being a completely balanced carbon expended by way of your travel and then offsetting that through some mechanism. I think increasingly there are calls to improve the way in which we do that accounting and that we actually verify that, say, mm-hmm. the carbon offset we're purchasing or investing in translates into real one-for-one emissions reductions. And so that is fraught. I think, unfortunately, the burden of responsibility to understand what an offset might purchase really still falls to the individual, which is a shame.
Yeah,
I do think there are ways to do it. I think the eyes wide open approach is really important. And I think we need to be really honest. I think this is something that I am personally struggling with as someone who has demands on their career to travel, demands personally to travel, both out of a desire, but also I have a brother who lives in Tunisia. And travel was a big aspect of what inspired me to become a scientist. I never wanted to be a scientist, and opportunities to see parts of the world that are changing rapidly, including the high Arctic, transformed my life. So I have to square these things as well.
The problem, that the hurdle I see, is how to know what is effective mitigation. I wish there was a government seal of, like, what we used to have, the good housekeeping seal or something like that. If anybody comes along and says, if you plant 6 trees, you can fly to Europe. You know, I think that's a little too easy. But how are we going to know? If you talk to people who make money selling carbon offsets, you're not going to get an unbiased opinion. Is there no government organization that sees the value of letting us consume in the area of mitigation smartly?
Not quite yet. And right, I think, you know, the adage that we often use in other aspects of our life, like if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Yeah. That's also true in the landscape of emissions reduction, carbon offsets, and broadly, I think climate solutions. Greenwashing is a very real thing because there is corporate gain that stems from convincing an increasingly broad base of consumers who want to be sustainable, who want to be thoughtful and intentional with where they place their dollars and the decisions they make. So I think, yes, there are ways to go about it, but I will say that we know we need to reduce emissions, and some of that also comes down to thinking about, is there one less trip a year you might take? Can you combine travel? Mm-hmm. Often the biggest source of emissions from an individual, particularly in the United States, stems from travel, air travel in particular. And so being really intentional and also honest with ourselves, right? There are mm-hmm. impacts that stem from our travel and not just the flying piece, right? So to your point, and something that you represent so well, which is this eyes wide open travel. And when you do come back from that trip, that's broadened your horizon and changed your perspective. Climate is part of that cadence of action and engagement. It doesn't go away when you pull into the gate.
And, you know, you can educate yourself. That's what your book is all about, the Climate Action Handbook. And there you've got a little section on how flying business class or first class takes more carbon than flying economy. So for 6 hours, you've got that comfort, but you've doubled your contribution to the problem. As a consumer, you need to do that knowing the cost. I wish we had a little light that went up. Every time we did something, they would say, you know, you're driving, but you could take the train. That cost this. The fun thing about your book is it offers 100 varied and doable solutions that in themselves, they don't seem to make that much difference. But as you point out, collectively, it has to be climate change needs a death by, what do you call it, a thousand little pinpricks.
Absolutely. Every single one of us can be that meaningful pinprick, right? And if we all pretend it's someone else's problem to solve, then of course, we're not going to be making any meaningful steps forward when we know that that's not just one foot in front of the other. It's actually one foot in front of the other as fast as we can possibly go. And the book for me was really an attempt to educate myself. Mm-hmm. Even though I study climate change and I like to think I'm part of the solution, every single talk, someone would ask, but Heidi, what can I do? How mm-hmm. can I help? I mm-hmm. want to be part of the solution. Does anything I do matter? And I felt like I needed to learn and actually reframe that conversation. And so not just talk about electric vehicles or flying less, but the multitude of ways that opportunities for solutions show up every day around us, from the breakfast table to our commute to work, and what conversations we potentially dare to have.
Dr. Heidi Roop's our guest on Travel with Rick Steves. She's a climate scientist and researcher who's compiled 100 actionable ideas in her book, The Climate Action Handbook. It's an illustrated guide to starting and sustaining our own climate action journeys in how we drive, work, travel, eat, shop, stay healthy, and take care of our homes and communities. We have links to her work with the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. A big part of your book, Heidi, is hope. What is the hope on the technology front? I mean, some of us just close our eyes and imagine a big vacuum cleaner in the sky that would swoop it all up and then, you know, send it to the moon. I don't know. I just talked to somebody in Stockholm who's all excited about making flying Teslas. You know, they're getting an electronic powered airplane. Apparently it's in the works. What are you excited about in the area of tech improvements to fight this?
I don't know that that really spins my wheels, Rick, if I'm being honest, right. Technology and climate. I think that there is absolutely a place for it and, quite frankly, absolutely a necessity. If we are going to achieve any of our global targets for trying to prevent the worst consequences of climate change on society, we have to deploy technology. But that technology is what I like to call the last mile. Mm. It's the technology that's really going to push us that last mile to help us achieve these ambitious targets. But we also need to, quite frankly, pick the low-hanging fruit. We Yep. know where greenhouse gases come from. We know the energy-intensive sectors. And we often know what solutions we need to deploy in those sectors. So it's a yes and. But we can't wait for it to save us.
Now, you said in your book, just 100 companies are responsible for 71% of industrial emissions. That sounds very tangible and finite. 100 companies are responsible for 3/4 of the industrial emissions. What percent of the problem is industrial emissions?
Pretty significant percent. So it depends on which industry. Of course, we don't make it simple when we sort of start to slice and dice the emissions pie. You know, things like cement and concrete fall in a slightly different sector of industrial emissions. But a lot of those 100 companies are unsurprisingly fossil fuel companies. And of course, it takes time to transition these large companies away from fossil fuels. We're mm-hmm. in the process of doing that. But it doesn't come without resistance, right? The status quo and something that makes money is, of course, sometimes the easiest path. Mm-hmm. And we are often not necessarily accounting for the real costs that stem from the combustion of fossil fuels, whether those are lives, how do we calculate the value of someone's health and well-being, or quite frankly, their life. We know there are millions of premature deaths annually that are attributed to the combustion of fossil fuels. So while we know the sources, there's still resistance. And this is, again, where I think we really need individuals because we are also part of those systems and where we can, those of us who have agency to make different decisions can help pave the way for more of us to opt in to alternatives.
And how important is government action? I mean, politics. This is so fundamental, but it's got to take government leadership, doesn't it? I mean, we're not going to do it without the government on board.
It takes government leadership, and it takes multiple forms of leadership, I think, in the government. It takes all of our political systems. One of the things that I like to talk about that I learned in the book, I think I inherently knew it, but I had never really placed numbers on it. And this is that 0.1% of our elected leaders work at the federal level.
Yeah, that's 1 out of 1,000.
So 96.3% in turn work in our local communities. But more often than not, we're talking about that 0.1%. It's a powerful 0.1%. They distribute money downstream to all those local elected leaders. But we live in a political ecosystem. Those local leaders also make decisions about where money goes or how our electric utilities can be regulated. That can often happen at the state level. Our school boards help determine what gets taught, what school meals are provided, whether idling is allowed outside of a school door. There are all sorts of decisions that climate intersects with. I like to use an example in Minnesota. We love our winters. We're very proud of our hardiness. But this last winter, I heard so much about potholes. We have some infrastructure challenges that are being made worse by climate change. So for me, a pothole in the road is an opportunity for a climate conversation because my local elected leaders are driving over those same potholes, damaging their vehicles too. So there's a common source of frustration. And if we can find those entry points to say, you know what, we could start solving for, you might care about roads that function, right? In order to have a road that functions, we now have to think about climate change and design that road with climate change in mind. You'd be surprised to know that that's not happening on a regular basis in most of our communities around the country.
And that sounds like the takeaway you'd like when people get your book, The Climate Action Handbook.
Find something that excites you, lean into your strengths and passions, and then find something else. We can't fall prey to single action bias, right? It's not enough to just offset your carbon. There's another meaningful way for you to be part of the climate solution, whether that's the wine you drink at night or the conversations you have with families or friends. Climate solutions surround us.
You know, Dr. Roop, I think whatever we're passionate about, you could think of 100 people, they all got 100 different things they're passionate about. All those things we are passionate about will be impacted down the road by our inaction today.
Absolutely. And my guess is that all of those things you're passionate about, there's an opportunity to be part of the climate solution there too.
There you go. Thank you so much for your work. And you've inspired me and you've inspired countless people with your book, The Climate Action Handbook. Thanks, Dr. Roop.
Thank you.
Would you hew me to the hardwood cutter? You lay me low beneath your feet. Listen to my sap mutter. Hear my heart would beat. Hear my heart would.
Heidi Roop teaches climate science at the University of Minnesota, where she heads their Climate Adaptation Partnership. She posts more ideas from her Climate Action Handbook on her website, HeidiRoop.com. That's spelled R-O-O-P. Hear how to give the new year a grand welcome with the traditions and superstitions they observe in Edinburgh, Scotland. It's in an extra for this week's show. You can hear that from our website at ricksteves.com/radio. Up next, we'll hear how a half century of German pop and rock music amplifies how their society has changed. It's Travel with Rick Steves.